Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
The word resurrection means many things, including renewal, restoration, revitalization, a new life. Some years ago, I experienced this sense of renewal of life in mind and body and spirit after a major heart operation. It was a kind of personal resurrection, if you like, a return to life. I call the poem Begin because that's precisely what it felt like. The adventure of life was starting all over again. Begin again to the summoning birds, to the sight of light at the window. Begin to the roar of morning traffic all along Pembroke Road. Every beginning is a promise, born in light and dying in dark. Determination and exultation of springtime, flowering the way to work. Begin to the pageant of queuing girls, to the arrogant loneliness of swans in the canal, to bridges linking the past and future, old friends passing, though with us still. Begin to the loneliness that cannot end, since it, perhaps, is what makes us begin. Begin to wonder at unknown faces, at crying birds in the sudden rain, at branches stark in the willing sunlight, at seagulls foraging for bread, at couples sharing a sunny secret, alone, together, while making good. Though we live in a world that dreams of ending, that always seems about to give in, something that will not acknowledge conclusion insists that we forever begin.
When my only daughter said she was getting married, we were delighted. She was in love with a good man who was in love with her. So far, so good. The next question was, had she set the date? And what kind of wedding was planned? It was to be a classic wedding. Bridesmaids, groomsmen, and appropriate mother of the bride attire would be needed. It was a long engagement, with a date set for almost 2 years in the future. This was a relief. I was a late starter in many things in my life, and having babies was no exception. This daughter was born when I was pushing 40, so I realised being mother of the bride was going to be a challenge when I set about looking online at appropriate fashions for the occasion. I found images of thin women in those dress, jacket, hat combinations and very high heels that are not designed for a portly woman measuring 5'2" in her stocking feet. I also found a lot of flowery chiffon. Enough said. Rejecting the online options, I trekked with the bride-to-be to every outlet in Dublin and then ventured into neighbouring counties. The overwhelming judgment was that I was too big. No one said that, of course, but when XXL doesn't fit you and when you squeeze yourself into outfits, even ones costing a lot of money, and there are women muttering about being able to let it out, you know you're in trouble. Then there was the hair. Even before COVID, I had decided to stop dyeing it and let it go grey. The problem was that it didn't go uniformly so, but remained a stubborn dark shade at the back, with a yellowish white section around the forehead and temples. There was a certain skunk-like vibe about it. Then, for the first time in my life, I began to worry about my teeth. They were my own. My poor mother had dentures before she was out of her 40s, so I was proud of this, until now. A radical makeover took place. I got new caps on my front teeth. I spent more money than I can admit on reshaping and dyeing my hair. I got new glasses. I had my eyebrows tinted and threaded. The pain involved surprised me greatly. I did not go on a diet. I have been struggling with my weight for over 50 years now, and I have surrendered. Neither did I resort to shapewear. After an experimental outing in one such garment ended in a very embarrassing episode in the ladies' room of a renowned department store. I had to lock myself in a cubicle, take off all my clothes, and get help to extricate myself in order to breathe again before I fainted. I imagined myself in less wholesome circumstances with a couple of gin and tonics on board and decided that wearing my own shape was preferable. My daughter, meanwhile, with little fuss, had found the perfect wedding dress, all the appropriate accessories, dressed her bridesmaids, advised on the groomsmen, and organised the whole day. But I was still looking. We got there in the end. I found a dress. A hat, shoes and a bag were purchased and deemed appropriate by the steering committee, and I was all set. While the wedding wasn't in a church, the walking down the aisle tradition was to be observed. Our little family is made up of my son, my daughter and I. So we agreed that her brother and I would enter the ceremony room on each side of the bride and walk her to her groom. There was no prouder woman in the world at that moment when the three of us stepped into view and the celebrant prompted a round of applause. Everyone stood up and turned around to get a good look at us. The bride was stunning in ivory. My son was rocking it in a beautiful suit, and I was after spending 2 years and a lot of money to look as good as humanly possible for this exact moment. I looked around the room and saw the women there who had helped me raise two children, sometimes in chaotic and heartbreaking circumstances, to become the two fine young adults walking beside me. As the applause became more raucous and turned to cheering and tears, I knew that I could have been walking down that room in a sack, because all that mattered that day was love. The couple's love for each other, my son and his wife, my partner and I, and all those friends wishing them a long and happy life together. Because love, although far from blind, looks with the heart and not with the eye.
One night, as I was cooking mushrooms for dinner in my Dublin kitchen, I was surprised to receive a phone call from Michael Graves. Would a teaching position at Princeton be of interest? Taking this to be a call from a joking friend, I laughed, cursed the phony caller, and hung up. The telephone rang again, and unperturbed, Michael Graves, then at the height of his fame as an international architect and an influential professor at Princeton, graciously apologized for that abrupt break in connection and politely repeated his invitation. Short notice, admittedly, but would I be prepared to consider coming over to teach with him that semester? He remembered my work from a group exhibition he'd seen at the Architectural Association in London. The semester would start in 3 weeks. I could work with him to set the design brief. That teaching opportunity at Princeton was my introduction to America, the USA having been considered off-limits when I was a student, its allure tainted by the horrors of the not-so-long-ago Vietnam War. I was picked up at the airport in a limousine, whisked past the movie-familiar but still distant Manhattan skyline, to arrive at a prim and proper guesthouse in this sleepy university town. I was greeted by the genial dean. "Hello, John. Welcome to Princeton. Would you like a glass of white wine or perhaps a crap after your long journey?" I settled into an austere apartment borrowed from a visiting professor, a mentor from my early years working in London. Spacious and spartan, with rooms full of books that maintained his silent aura, but not a novel in sight. 3 mornings a week, teaching in the design studio, a small group of graduate students for me to work with, then a handy train ride into New York, where my American education developed, street by street, block by block, week by week. New York felt more old-fashioned than I might have expected. Cast iron radiators hissed in the night. Steam rose out of gratings in the street. The subway clattered under bulky steel girders. Bathroom taps, fancifully known as faucets, operated like clunky prototypes, gushing flows of piping hot water. The skyline of New York seemed nostalgic for the 20th century, a young city that hadn't moved far from the shape of its foundations. It was new and exciting, but old and restoring at the same time, the thickness of steel plates thrown down to cover a hole in the road, the width of the paving stones in front of the New York Public Library. The skyscrapers, satisfyingly solid, hit the ground without much of a fuss, sitting down squarely on relatively small plots. The blocks were regular and easy to navigate. The city had a reassuring continuity about it. Restaurants and bars were buzzing, like I knew they would be from so many nights in the cinema. Find me a cozier club, a less pretentious scene than the basement of the Village Vanguard. Famous from classic jazz recordings, the place itself turned out to be comfortingly shabby, if a little hard to find, hiding in plain sight. I took a ride on the Staten Island ferry because I knew it had to be done. I didn't bother to alight on the island side, returning on the same ticket. But the rumble and vibration of its departure, the voyage across the wide river, the view to the Statue of Liberty, the throbbing sensation of the ferry docking heavily into its jetty, made this as much of a mythical journey as any imagined descent into Hades. My first day in Manhattan, as I sat in a coffee bar on Broadway, a homeless man stared in at me from out on the street. Then, striding back the width of the sidewalk, he sprang full tilt, flinging himself to land four square, 2 feet and both hands up against the plate glass, the window flexed inwards in its frame. I must have looked worried to the waitress. "Ah, shucks, he does that 4-5 times a day. You want another coffee, honey?" After that unsettling rite of initiation, I hailed a yellow cab and, settling in the back seat, gave the driver the exact address of an architecture gallery on Canal Street. He pulled over to the curb and hollered, "You want to get out of the car?" Apparently, or so I was sharply told, you go by cross street intersections, not by house numbers, in this most numbered city. Why do deadly dull names like Fifth Avenue or 42nd Street carry so many sentimental associations? How can endlessly straight avenues, numbered simply 1 to 9, communicate so much image-laden information? And why does all this rudeness, beeping horns, lane-dodging yellow taxis, lights flashing, walk, don't walk, seem so consoling? Gotham City's got a lot shinier than it seemed on my first expedition in 1987, but it hasn't lost its charm. I value my connections, personal and academic, with America. Like every Irish child of my generation, I grew up with the idea of America in my bones. Admittedly, my contact with that society has been limited to the Northeast Fringe, a sympathetic arena where I've made lasting friendships. It was suggested to me at a post-lecture dinner in Baltimore that an aerial survey of foul drainage systems could help discriminate red from blue states. Where the streets and houses are connected to a public sewage network, you could assume one sort of political majority. Widespread reliance on septic tank disposal would be downright proof of a different predilection in the population. One demographic knew how much they depended on one another. The other shower believed they could go it alone. These days, I travel to America for teaching or for work, always eager for the inspiration of its anonymous building tradition and the brilliance of its 20th century architecture, mightily impressed by the monumental geology of its canyon landscapes, and marvelling still at the street canyons of old New York.
New York, to that tall skyline I come, flying in from London to your door. New York.
Scale Mawamo Gurum. Panantabire kene mope upane, tokane mope upane. Tokane alamotir, irimokroku and panarisme. Anantansuma, anantansuma, irimokroku and panarisme. Manantabire kine mope upane, tokane mope upane, tokane alamotir, irimokroku and panarisme. Anantansuma, anantansuma, irimokroku and panarisme. That's a Timne song I only learned phonetically from Teta, my African grandmother. She told me and my dad different versions of the story in that song, knowing neither of us understood the language and could query her. Little did she know that after she died, we would cross-reference her two versions and compare phonetics for a song we only stored in our memory. My dad said it was about grinding fufu in a big bowl with a stick, and how my partner left me, but there are lots of other bowls I can grind my stick in. But my grandmother told me that it was about a young woman who got broken up with and was slagging off her old boyfriend, saying his ass was flat like a stick, and that that was a part she wouldn't miss. In my dreams, there are figurines lined up in my aunt's shed. They are protected by my cousins. Their father ran away, and now they make little men in clay and line them up for her. My grandmother's funeral was held in Dublin in 2014. The family sent her body back to Ireland to be buried in Deansgrange Cemetery with Rida, her Syrian husband, even though she died in her homeland, in Freetown, Sierra Leone. She should have been buried in the forest with her ancestors. Walking back is full of sorrow and is hard to navigate. In the dream, there is a broken platform leading to a door and a stairway that all the ironwork has nearly rotted out of. My grandmother told me, as we walked through town, that in London the ironworks were all smelted into bullets in World War II. War is part of the landscape. The warrior tomb, the ironless gates, now just standing, leaning against pieces of stone. Rida, my grandfather, reached for balance, having leant in that direction for so long. It was something he felt missing from his structure. It was something he was trying to replace. A sea mineral, a shell, a home, loving food, a place to go. In the dream, I no longer get to pass the threshold. The threshold engraved with spirals and symbols, figures I'm not sure of. I can run my hand along its surface, but never understand. Floating stone platform. Floating meaning, floating identity, floating history, suspended fictions, all part of a true story and a dream. Scale Mawamo Bon, Knopsa Scornach. Lucy, my Irish grandmother, was always pregnant. Her husband wanted her body all the time. In my mother's family, they had a child in every class in primary school. Eight of them in all. I try to speak in silent thought. Where are you going? Look at me when I'm talking to you. Going back inside herself. Do you know why I look down? I have a torso. It's being crushed. Going in and out of ourselves. Married without knowing what love was. Teta could not read or write, so her stories are not written down and can be forgotten. Lucy didn't tell her stories to anyone, and so they cannot be remembered. Swallowing so many stones, you turn into one. Thinking of lumps, like emotional gastroliths. Stones that get swallowed to help us digest our experience. The stones stay hard inside us. Stones that cannot leave the body do not get processed. My grandmother Lucy, born in the early years of the Irish Free State. Her father participated in the liberation of Haddington Road. My mother told me he had carried the Irish flag into the nearby barracks, and that his brother was in the English army, and that they had fought on opposite sides of the War of Independence. Lucy had been educated through Irish and had a difficult experience with the language. She was left-handed, a kittog, and was punished for this. The devil was in the left hand. As a young woman, Lucy set up her own business as a dressmaker of bridal wear and clothing for the emerging middle class in Ireland. Knap no cluch sa scornach. Undigested blockages build up behind them. Things that are repressed, squished. My grandmother Lucy, who died the year I was born, had a lump, but she never talked about it. She had a lump, but she decided it wasn't there. What is it when you deny your body? What is it when your body carries something that can't be broken down and things persist? My mother told me it was hard to see Lucy lose herself. Her appearance and her value were connected. My mother buying her mother a prosthetic breast in Arnott's basement. When Lucy's appearance changed, she felt less. The lump in her breast took her life. It petrified her. They carved away not just the breast, but the flesh of the ribs and the back and the arm. It all had to go. I feel like sometimes my family can only function on an agreed silence. There is a knowledge of what has happened to her, and we don't tell everyone. We feel them judge us by the suffering she endured to give us all life. Stone prosthetic breast. Gastrolith of my grandmother's suffering. I swallowed a stone and it stayed inside me. Swallowed many stones, heavy belly, crush me, suck me, bury me in stones, make me. Disappear in stone, stack me, build me, up inside these stones, memory, story, hides inside these stones, with me, for me, me. Me, me.
A polite young man of a dropped, gaping jaw struggled to divert his gaze. Cup of tea in hand, he appeared to suffer from a sudden bout of what my mother would call stunism. It was no wonder, hadn't his beautiful dance date just ripped the wig off her head, only to fling it on the sofa where it landed, along with the same swift movement that brought her through the door only minutes before. Her large, bulbous, pink, sweaty forehead revealed itself, dented in by a greenish-white crease line where the wig had previously been digging into her skin. So much reality, so little illusion, the abrupt breaking of a spell. What was the source of his repulsion? Was he someone of such superficial leanings? Or was it an illusion he had fallen for? And why had such a heaving turn been visited on him? My mother reenacted this event for us many times. I loved the brave honesty of the woman in the story and her lack of desire to maintain her self-created illusion. I was fascinated at how someone could be so confident to do such a thing in front of someone she had just been on a date with. My own experience of wig wearing is different. Early in my performing career, while on tour in America and on a budget, I shared a hotel room with two musicians. I didn't know them well, and one of them was very much in awe of my music and artistry. And realising that I was in a bind because I was wearing an adorned wig, I resolved that I would just sleep with the wig firmly attached to my head, hairpins and brightly coloured headband in place, even though the getup was remarkably uncomfortable. The same musicians nowadays enjoy recounting the night when I slept in all my clothes, full makeup and wig, simply because I was so professional. Years later, when I was co-presenting a music series for radio, it was unexpectedly announced that we would be doing a photo shoot on that very day. I was utterly thrown. Miles from home, I didn't have the wig with me. Getting my hands on it would mean someone having to break into my house to get it before getting it to me. Even so, the absolute necessity for me was clear. I needed the wig. But it doesn't stop there. I need things on top of the wig. A friend of mine, who has worn a dicky bow every day of his life, once asked me why I wore that owl hat on my head when I was singing. He wanted to know what I needed it for. "Can you not just sing the songs?" he said. Another voice from the ether of my past goes, "He's 60 years blown the same old trumpet, and not everyone liked it either, you know." I think of the many times I've been asked, "And are you still at the old music now, Julie? And would you be at that now all day?" And it all well meant. But could I have also heard, "A right good clip of the old wings she needs. Sure they were saying 'twas only some old class of a jingle thing she was at." It's definitely hard succeeding in living life as an artist, and it can be regarded by some as a fanciful indulgence, even to be one, but it's a compulsion that I can't shake off. Creative impulses pass through me like indescribable flashes, coaxing and luring me to inhabit a place in my mind. They propel a flight for me into a newly painted world. Visual objects hold so much story, resonance and magic for me. Whether reaching into an undiscovered dimension in my performance or committing to a persona or a character by wearing a wig or a hat, the visual world gives me fire. Fire to express myself in the ways that I am best at. There, I can truly be free. Now, where is that wig?
The moon is rising as I reach the ruin of my grandmother's childhood home. Although the light is poor and the sunken field a wild tangle, I step nimbly through the clawing briars, retaking habit-formed steps.
I feel more acutely the weight of my easel once I free my shoulder of its strap. I flex fingers numb from carrying my pent-filled toolbox. I stand and breathe in the sea, acknowledging, as always, that the 10 inhabitants of this two-roomed, one-chimney stone cottage would have inhaled the same briny tang in their day. I first pented here as a boy, when Granny was still alive, our lives overlapping for 8 precious years. Maggie O'Donnell was bedbound during this twilight time. The hillside cottage in which my mother grew up, beginning its slow fall into decay, Granny moved into our house, which was struggling to climb out of disrepair. I became my grandmother's bedside companion, a listener to old stories, a friend. I took up art in the first place simply to brighten her evenings. She missed the glories of the natural world, the imprint of pleasure I gained from placing trees and fields and skies into her frail hands has remained with me all my life. The odour of turpentine escapes into the air. I am painting a wind-sculpted hawthorn tree that I first painted, probably on the back of a cornflakes box, in the 1970s. More recently, I've been painting it and many other trees that grow locally for longer than a decade, across the seasons, at all times of day and night, in all weathers. This hawthorn was known to my grandmother as a girl. Painting its branches as the light fades, I am continuing our conversations of long ago, still listening, still learning. In 1987, the year I finished school and enrolled as a painting student at the National College of Art and Design in Dublin, the novelist and essayist John Berger wrote that very few peasants become artists. Occasionally, perhaps, the son or daughter of peasants has done so. For this reason, Berger went on, the peasant's soul is unfamiliar or unknown to most urban people. I was the first member of my family to attend secondary school and the first to study into adulthood, attaining a degree. Growing up, I hardly ever went beyond the distance to which my legs could carry me. It grows darker and a bat swoops. The luminance level becomes so low that the colour cones in my eyes shut down and I see only with the rods. Part of my project as a painter is the experience of my body interacting with the landscape. If I painted indoors, it couldn't happen that the landscape controls my eyesight. In the past, my family worked outdoors, spending most of their lives in the open. With my paintbrush, I am passing these living hours in the same fields along the same coastline. They lived in their bodies in a way that fewer of us do today. I paint with my body, in my body, and will until my body is no more. Back in my log cabin, I have a bookcase crammed with old books about Donegal. These shelves themselves tell a story. It is easy to romanticise a heritage such as mine, largely because educated and privileged outsiders have mostly told our stories. Harry Percival Swan was born into a prosperous milling family in 1879. Educated at Foyle College in Derry, and became a successful entrepreneur, his accolades including the presidency of the Donegal Historical Society. Of his books, the titles I own are Romantic Inishowen and Romantic Stories and Legends of Donegal. Patrick McGill was born into a poor peasant family in Glenties, sometime around 1890, and his formal education at the village school ended at age 10. 2 years later, sent to the hiring fair at Strabane, he was flung into a world of hunger and brutal labour. The titles of McGill's books include The Rat Pit and Children of the Dead End. My grandmother had a rudimentary education, which ended before her 13th birthday. Despite this, she devoured newspapers. I remember her as a beautiful storyteller. From her tapestry of tales, I learned that well-woven words could bring people and places to life. It feels natural that I converse with ancestors across time through the medium of landscape. In Granny's stories, no field or tree or rock was mute. All were individuals, meriting time and reverence. Each field a world unto itself. By climbing over a dry stone wall, one opened to the presence of the past. I pack away my painted hawthorn. I fold up my easel. Strolling along the moonlit road, I'm aware that viewed from a distance, I might cut a romantic figure. But this would not tell the entire story.
The writing this morning was Begin by Brendan Kennelly from the Sunday Miscellany Archive of 2004. All You Need Is Love was by Kathy Power. Discovering America by John Toomey. Mamo Gurum agus Mamo Bon by Alice Rekab. The Wig was by Julie Feeney. And Painting by Owlite by Cornelius Brown. The music on the programme was The Dance by Roger Doyle, Munster Cloak by The Chieftains, A Heart in New York by Benny Gallagher and Graham Lyle, performed live in Central Park by Simon and Garfunkel. Song for Mama was by Lady Felicia, and Bohemian Rag was by Peter O'Brien. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon, and the producer was Cliona Nian Lewin. And you can listen back to this morning's programme if you like on the RTE radio app or on the programme website, rte.ie/radio/radio1/Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.